I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fog of dying key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots of little... This is an article by Father Raymond D'Souza writing for the National Post. It's called The Slaughter of the Lambs. You know, you all recall the boo-hoo-hooing and the big orgy of white guilt and so on after the shooting of the killing of 50, now it's actually probably 51 Muslims at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, a little over a month ago. Now, I commented on it at the time. I read published the manifesto of the shooter. I agreed with his analysis that we are being replaced. We're being replaced racially in Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, by policy. And he may have not emphasized this quite as much. It's an invasion, yes, but it's an invasion largely enabled by our own rotten ruling class. Anyway, I agreed with most of his analysis. I did not agree with much of his grab bag personal history. I mean, it's not a matter of disagreeing or disagreeing. I mean, I didn't approve. His history is his history. But I do not approve of the violence. I do not think killing these people was tactically the right thing to do, nor was it morally the right thing to do. But anyway, you'll also recall that in many parts of North America, and certainly where I live in and around the Toronto area, in Canada, there was quite an outpouring of sympathy. In fact, white guilt, and over an hour was devoted in the Canadian House of Commons to denouncing it, and our Prime Minister spoke for 17 minutes denouncing white supremacy. The leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, said there was no room for white supremacists in Canada. I mean, what do you mean there's no room for a citizen who... and of course, white supremacy is largely a defamation. What they really mean is white nationalism. Or what they really mean is people who have awakened to the fact that there's an immigration replacement in place by policy. We didn't lose a war, you know. We're being replaced by policy. Anyway, there was all sorts of gatherings of Christians and Jews. Jews and Christians who went to mosques or had vigils and so on, conveying their condolences. And I've contrasted that more recently with the distinct lack of noise in the wake of over 250 Christians being killed 2 weeks ago on Easter Sunday at several churches in Ceylon or Sri Lanka and several hotels. It was an ISIS operation undertaken mostly by upper-class Muslims from Sri Lanka. These are not, not that it would be an excuse, but the poor people from the slums striking out at an order that, didn't seem to have room for them. There was nothing like that. These are privileged people committing these most appalling acts of murder against Christians. Now, you would have thought, as the death toll was already five times higher than what happened in Christchurch, that there would be at least a similar outpouring. Well, there's the perfunctory condemnations, of course, from our Prime Minister and various other leaders. But then life goes on. There were no mass vigils. I'm not aware of Muslims or Jews coming to Catholic churches to convey their condolences. But anyway, all of that's kind of interesting because for all we heard about the white supremacists in Christchurch, the death toll among Christians, mostly, as a matter of fact, non-white, it far exceeds anything that the odd white killing might do. And Father D'Souza writes, Holy Week began with the great fire at Notre Dame. And the surprise was that it wasn't arson, a deliberate attack, but an apparent accident. Well, I don't think he's right. I think it probably was arson, but okay. In 2018, French police reported that 875 churches, more than two a day, were vandalized. Let there be a Swazi spray painted on a synagogue in anywhere in North America, and it becomes front page news. And the politicians come out with stern looks on their faces and vows that anti-Semitism will not be tolerated, etc. Christian churches are routinely, that's two a day, vandalized in France, and it's a big ho-hum. In fact, I think that statistic would probably come as a considerable revelation to 99 out of 100, even relatively well-informed readers of Canada's media. Father D'Souza continues, just this year, another prominent church in Paris was set ablaze, and another was smeared with excrement and sacrilegious against the Holy Eucharist. In other words, the tabernacle that includes the blessed bread, which the Catholics believe is the body of Christ, was vandalized and probably unspeakable things done. Holy Week ended with the Islamist bombings of churches and hotels in Sri Lanka, killing some 350 people and wounding many others. On Tuesday, the Islamic State claimed responsibility. So, this isn't a matter of conspiracy theory. They claimed responsibility, and prominent, known members of an Islamic terrorist group killed themselves, to avoid arrest. So, all of this is, is well known. This time, the surprise is only where the massacre took place: Colombo and Negombo. These are two cities in Ceylon and Sri Lanka. There is no surprise that it took place on Easter Sunday. Christians are killed on Easter Sunday for being Christians every year. In 2019, yes, the same day as the bombing in Sri Lanka, an off-duty policeman rams his car into a group of children in an Easter procession in Gombe in Nigeria. He killed 9 people, and some 30 more children were injured. The motive for the attack has not been established, but it's clear who the victims were. Christian children celebrating Easter. And this is also quite a Muslim area of Nigeria, which is something that perhaps ought to be noted. On Palm Sunday, 2019, a week before the Sri Lanka bombings, an Assemblies of God church in Uttar Pradesh, India, was attacked by some 200 men who beat the pastor and congregation with sticks. That's in India. In 2018, a Catholic family was killed in Pakistan at Easter, and in India, a pastor was beaten badly while Hindu extremists stormed his church. In 2017, Coptic Christians in Egypt canceled many Holy Week services when bombings at 2 churches on Palm Sunday, that's of course the Sunday before Easter, killed 45 people. They're killed specifically for being Christians. In 2016, 75 people were killed and some 300 injured in a park in Lahore, Pakistan. The park was in a predominantly Christian neighborhood and was filled with Christian families having Easter lunches after the morning mass. In 2015, Islamist terrorists attacked Garissa University in Garissa, Kenya, killing 148 people during Holy Week. The university was home to both Christian and Muslim students, but the Christians were targeted for killing. That is just Easter. Terror attacks at Christmas are also not rare in recent years. Indeed, a few years back in Egypt, religious officials moved midnight mass to the afternoon after Christians had been attacked in successive years when coming to church in the night. In the aftermath of the Sri Lanka bombings, senior security officials are being fired for failing to heed intelligence warnings which came from India. The Indian intelligence basically gave the Sri Lankan authorities a blueprint and specific warnings about what was going to happen, and the warnings were ignored. That's a particular failure specific to this attack. But the general phenomenon of Christians being massacred in Holy Week means that we ought to expect that somewhere, independent of intelligence about a particular locale. I was in Sri Lanka in January 2015, writes Father D'Souza, for the visit of Pope Francis, who came to canonize Sri Lanka's first saint, Joseph Vaz. Like most Catholic visitors, I made a pilgrimage to the shrine of St. Anthony, bombed this past Sunday. And I visited Ngombo, known as a Little Rome, or local Vatican, for its many Catholic churches and shrines in the country where Christians are a small minority. St. Sebastian's Catholic parish in Ngombo was bombed on Sunday. In addition, Zion Church in Batacaloa was bombed, in addition to the 3 hotels where many people were enjoying an Easter brunch. But when Christians are massacred, it only matters marginally that I might know the place of the people involved. The dominant reality is that they were killed for doing what I and my parishioners are doing on Sunday morning, what we have a duty and a right to do, to worship God in peace. Every year, our fellow Christians are in mortal danger for doing just that. The Catholic Archbishop of Colombo, Cardinal Malcolm Ranjit, witnessing the carnage, said on Sunday that the perpetrators should be punished without mercy, for they are worse than animals. It was the cry of a pastor seeing the massacre of his flock. This is massively underreported and under-remarked upon by our media. You know, you have to ask, where are the Christian pastors? The Catholic pastors, the other Christian pastors of other denominations, where is the outrage that ought to be there? I want to thank David Baker for passing along Tomato Bubble to me. And Tomato Bubble is a really good blog by Mike King. And this is Mind-Altering Internet Classics of Real History, Economics, Philosophy, and Current Events. This is by Mike King, who also wrote a great book, The Bad War, about the Second World War. And this is actually, it seems to be not exactly what I expected or what I'd seen earlier. This is the history of global warming and the scam. It is essentially a scam. Oh yeah, here we are. And I have a picture here of a libtard protester at the March for Science in Philadelphia in April this year, 2017. A picture of Elon Musk, who said he would leave an advisory council for President Trump after the announcement that the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Accords. And very good on them, too, for doing that. And this is what Mike King wrote. Were it not for Trump's 2017 decision to stick it to the globalists by pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement, we'd all be paying some form of carbon tax right now, the way we Canadians are. As the world's leading emitter of harmless plant food molecules, that's carbon dioxide, I have to remember that. Our own Prime Minister, the Trust Fund Kid, calls the generation of carbon dioxide, it's a byproduct of the burning of fossil fuels like coal or wood or more usually gasoline or diesel, pollution. It's not pollution. It's not harmful. It's not like putting sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. As the world's leading emitter of harmless plant food molecules, carbon dioxide, this essentially means that the devious deal, in spite of China, India, and Russia's feigned commitment to the Paris scheme, will in due course die altogether, except perhaps in the communist European Union and many individual American states, and in dum-dum countries like Canada. Hopefully after the next election we will abolish it. But let's summarize some important historical propaganda milestones of the 40-year-old hoax that's evolved from being known as the greenhouse effect to global warming to climate change. And at one point all of these were sacrosanct ideas and very much received opinion. 1970 began with the great fanfare of the first Earth Day, April 22nd, which incidentally, it was also Lenin's birthday. Kicked off with CBS's then anchor Walter Cronkite, also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, hosting a nationally televised TV special. The theme of Saving the Planet was thus introduced to the gullible young hippie crowd who have since grown up to take over America at the behest of their invisible handlers. And there are some pictures of news coverage of the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. Between 1975 and 1978, during the mid-70s, scientific talk of a coming ice age, not necessarily related to pollution, was used to frighten the population. I remember that. There was a book called The Coming Ice Age. There's even a cover of Time magazine, The Cooling of America, and you see a family with what looks like a witch's hat huddled in blankets huddled around their TV. There's another graphic in search of the coming ice age. It's harder, it might, if you're not of a certain age, you probably don't remember that. But that was the big fear in the early 70s, coming ice age. It's funny, you know, that the people who make these alarmist remarks are not permanently disgraced, because they'll be back a couple of years later with exactly the opposite. Now, anybody can make a mistake, but you would think they would at least have the humility to say, look, we really goofed for these reasons, but this time we've got it right for these reasons. But oh no, it's always said with the greatest of assurance. Between 1979 and 1982, at a time when the world's population and plant food emissions were far lower than they are today, concerns about an ice age are suddenly replaced with tales of a greenhouse effect that's expected to wreak havoc by the year 2000. Remember that. That's by the year 2000. And what's today? 2019. That's 19 years later. After nearly 40 years, none of the dire predictions have come to pass as doomsday is again and again pushed off to yet another far-off day in our children's future. 1990. The children's TV show Captain Planet and the Planeteers is unveiled by globalist Ted Turner. The series will be broadcast on TBS from 1990 to 1992. A sequel series, The New Adventures of Captain Planet, is later broadcast from 1993 to 1996. Many millions of children, now in their 30s, were brainwashed by cartoons which featured the green-haired Captain Planet and his young planeteers battling against evil businesses and oil men such as Hoggish Greedley. In the early 1980s, images of the Statue of Liberty predicted to be underwater by 2000. Remember, that was a prediction. Well, have you checked out the chapter of the Statue of Liberty lately? Is it underwater or water halfway up to her waist? No, must have missed that one. These stories were used to frighten school children across America. Captain Planet and the Planeteers was evil communist propaganda aimed at helpless children, many of whom have now since grown up into libtards. 1992, Council on Foreign Relations member, Senator, and soon-to-be Vice President Al Gore publishes Earth in the Balance, in which he calls for a global Marshall Plan to save the planet. The book is hyped to the stars by the Sulzberger Slimes and the rest of the Piranha Press. And Sulzberger, of course, the Jewish owner of the New York Times. 2006, Al Gore, who had almost been elected president in 2000, authors another propaganda book entitled An Inconvenient Truth. Dealing solely with the so-called crisis of global warming, the error-filled book serves as the basis for a movie version directed by David Guggenheim. He's not Irish, incidentally. And narrated by Al Gore. Gore's fake film premieres at the 2006 Sundance Film Festival. The Marxist movie is then mega-hyped by the Piranha Press and wins two Academy Awards. It would later be shown in classrooms across America and Britain. Adding idiocy to insult, Gore is then awarded the Nobel Prize for his asinine activism. There's a graphic picture here. The world gone mad. Greasy Gore collects an Academy Award. Now, just to hang on to reality here, what did Gore predict? Well, he predicted that by 2013, the Arctic ice cap would have melted. Now, you know, when somebody signs on as a prophet, I mean, I think it's fair game to say, well, okay, how did your prophecies turn out? Did you get that one right? No, I think it's a perfectly fair question to ask. You know, so somebody holds himself forth as a prophet who wants to your attention as he has predicted the future. Well, I think it's a very, very fair question to say, well, okay, how did all that turn out? You know, you said these and those things would happen. Did they in fact happen? Or did they not happen? If you want to continue to be held forth as a prophet and respected as a prophet, well then, I think it's fair to ask, well, how did your prophecies turn out? This isn't being unkind. I think we have a pretty good answer that the Gore prophecies turned out very badly. That he was in fact wrong, substantially wrong. And yet the funny thing is, this doesn't send him scurrying off in disgrace. And that's something I find very remarkable. We tend not to hold these blowhards who command our attention. You know, And people acted on these worries. Anyway, in 2015, the Marxist Pope Francis issued an unprecedented edict directing his followers to believe that climate change is real. He condemns it as a sin and urges the world to take action. All of a sudden, the Jewish press loves a Catholic Pope. Francis is, from a traditional Catholic's point of view, an unmitigated disaster. And he welcomes mass immigration to Europe, which will only stress the environment further. He proclaims climate change to be a sin. Well, blame God. I don't mean to be smart-alecky about it, but human beings have virtually nothing to do with climate change. The climate is always changing, and it's caused by explosions on the sun that are called sunspots. And to the best of existing human knowledge, there's nothing we can do about it. In 2016, Hollywood's degenerate Leonardo DiCaprio released a National Geographic crocumentary about climate change. The pack of lies, massively hyped by the Piranha Press, is entitled Before the Flood. DiComio, I guess that's DiCaprio, and Pope Francis are now the biggest public faces pushing for action. Global taxes on plant food and NWO, New World Order, control over business, all in the name of stopping climate change. There's a caption here of Gore. A few years after his perverted sexual assault scandal and subsequent divorce, Gore's role as the main public face of the hoax, that's the climate change hoax, was assumed by Leonardo DiCaprio, or as Mike King calls him, DiComio, and the Pope. In the absence of any real science to support the outrageous claims, it was these propaganda initiatives combined with the never-ending fake news stories that brought nearly 50% of the American public to now believing in at least some degree of man-made climate change. Now, that's the important part, man-made. Climate change? Yeah, of course, climate's always changing. It's a classic case of bought-off science and manufactured consent being used to cover up the globalist agenda to tax the air we exhale and which plants happily inhale. Plants need carbon dioxide, and when they get it, they thrive. It's not pollution. And then they're going to transfer the New World Order people want to transfer the stolen wealth to UN bureaucrats and third world politicians. That's the truth, and the seditious scum at Sulzberger Slimes knows damn well it is. That's the New York Times. Bubus Americanus, cartoon here. I read in the New York Times today that the whole world Trump's pullout from the Paris Accords may have a devastating effect on the climate. Bubus Americanus 2. What an ass. All he cares about is raping Mother Earth for profit. They're accusing that of the president of that. I think a very good thumbnail history of the hoax that is climate change. That I should say, the hoax part of it being that man has anything to do with it. It's not a hoax that it's existing, of course. That the climate is changing, will continue to change. There's little that people can do about it, at least to stop it. As it changes in one direction or another, there may be things that people can do to adapt to it, or to lessen the effects. I also want to thank, trying to think of which of my many correspondents, and while I'm actually puzzling that out, just a brief message. I appreciate your sending me stories that you think I might be interested in, and I am. As I say, I do appreciate the stories. And you can send me material that you think might be of use to me, and you can send it to me at paul@paulfromm.com. Just email it to me, paul@paulfromm.com. And, you know, I cannot read everything. And as informed as I like to think I am, there are also all things I miss. There are areas I might not even look at. So you see something that you think might be of interest to me, I'm very, very grateful to have this passed on to me. And I believe it was my good friend Bauman, and the leader of the Citizens' Choice Party, who passed this on to me, and I'm still looking for it here. And it's a commentary by Tucker Carlson. While I'm Tucker Carlson is a really good commentator on Fox News. Of course, I wouldn't agree with everything he says, but he's actually been quite outspoken and quite good. This particular message of his has to do with the freedom of speech, I think. But it seems to have temporarily disappeared. So I'm going to play this on the elite class.
So I often read you described as a populist. Is Tucker Carlson populist? Are you a populist?
No!
I've never been a populist. I'm an elitist in the sense that I believe that all societies are hierarchical. You know, dogs are hierarchical. My dogs are. All dogs are. All animals are hierarchical. There's always someone in charge. So I don't believe in pure egalitarianism at all. I've never made that case. What I think is that populism is a warning sign that your system's about to collapse. Populism is the last stop before dictatorship, you know, always. And so the second you get a populist movement brewing, you need to stop and ask yourself, what gave rise to this? What did I do wrong that allowed space for this? But no, my argument is not against elites. My argument is against the shitty elites we have, who have no idea what they're doing and won't admit it, who are small-minded, and who are very different from previous generations of elites in the following way. They feel no responsibility to those below them. So the robber barons, I mean, their excesses were mitigated by Protestant guilt. But they really felt, I mean, and they weren't, a lot of them weren't good people. I'm not making a case on behalf of the factory owners, that's for sure. But I am saying what's true, which is, they felt like, well, gee, you know, I've been blessed. Andrew Carnegie, you know, grew up penniless in Scotland, showed up here, made billions in modern dollars, and gave a ton of it away, most of it away. Built over 1,000 libraries. Why? Just because he thought people should read. Like, he really felt like I have an obligation to give back to the country that made all of this possible. Because he didn't think that he was solely responsible for all he made. The people currently in charge believe, because they've internalized the lies of the meritocratic system, believe that they're rich because they're just inherently better. They deserve everything they have. They have no guilt. And a little bit of guilt is good.
Well, they don't.
Our leaders don't feel that way at all.
Well, they don't even know the factory worker now. The assembly line's in a different country.
They don't care.
The assembly line's in China.
Yeah, they put it there. They,
and meaning they don't know any of the people who were involved. Like, how often does Apple think about the suicides of Foxconn? I mean, are they thinking about this, really?
Never. Never. But look, you know, guilt is, there's a continuum of guilt. I'm not a particularly guilty guy myself, and I don't think that you are. I think too much guilt, you know, clearly distorts you and makes you do unwise and counterproductive things.
Yeah.
But I'm not even, actually, to put a finer point on it, it's not even guilt that I think we're missing. It's a recognition, it's a kind of Calvinist recognition. You're not really the author of your own fate. You can make wise decisions, and you're rewarded for those over time on average.
Yeah.
But the truth is, nobody is responsible for everything he has or doesn't have. You're not the product of your decisions exclusively. That's a full-on lie. And everyone in America has been told that, and the dumb people believe it. Unfortunately, they're not running things. And so they look around, and they're like, well, yeah, I've got, you know, a house in Greenwich and a house in Vail and a place in St. Bart's, and why do I have those things? Because I'm just way better than the people who don't have them.
Whereas previous generations grew up in a world where their children died of diphtheria. And it was just very obvious that you couldn't control your life. Now, because we deny death, we can imagine that we're God. And that's why, by the way, a ruling class is so committed to abortion, the death penalty, and war, because killing gives people the illusion of omnipotence. And so it's a way to continue this completely demented lie that we tell ourselves, that we're fully in charge. You're not in charge. Really, do you think you're in charge? Watch a kid die of cancer.
Right.
You really in charge? So that is the core mistake, I would argue the core sin of our ruling class, is believing that they're God. And once you think you're God, like, does God have a moral responsibility to people beneath him? Of course not. He's God. Mm-hmm. They have a responsibility to worship him. And when they don't, they must be punished. And that's what you're watching now.
So when conservatives hear you talk about the house and veil, like, the rich guy got the house and veil, who thinks he earned it on his own, they all get nervous. And rightfully, I mean, I can feel it too.
I just want to be very clear. I am a rich guy.
Right.
I grew up a rich guy. I'm a rich guy now. I'm not attacking rich people. What I'm attacking is the attitude that they have.
Sure. So, but do you, I guess, my instinct in this may just be part of the way I'm brought up, but thinking from a conservative perspective, is I can feel inside of me this idea that that's kind of laying the groundwork for the torches and pitchforks. Just like storm the barricades, go after the rich.
But I'm against that. What I'm saying is, again, populism is a warning to everybody. It is really, it's an air raid siren. Holy smokes, this is not working. Democratic societies, democracies, cannot continue unless they are predominantly middle-class, bourgeois people rooted in the country.
So if the ruling class wants to continue to enjoy the comfort of their blessings, they need to care for the people who are less.
I've said this like 50 times, and it's like, it's not even care for, so it's actually even more nuanced than that. It's not, so the default position of the people who, you know, made a bundle in finance or private equity or some other totally fake sector of our economy, they sort of know that, like, I didn't really create anything. I'm lending money at interest and getting rich off that. Mm-hmm. It's not really an honorable way to make a living. I kind of feel bad about it on some level. They're sort of hip to this deal, okay? So how do you expiate your guilt? Well, you do it by helping the poor, usually in some foreign country, because they're so obviously poor. So there are two problems with this. One is, you know, your first debt is to the people around you, and then your greater debt is to your neighbors, and then to the country. It's the concentric circles understanding of personal obligation, right? Okay? So make sure your wife and kids are okay, then make sure your neighbors are okay, and your cousins, and then make sure your country's okay. No, they go right to Somalia, okay? Because it's easy, and there's no actual obligation. Okay, you just send a check and you're done. But the second mistake they make is imagining that the real problem is the poor. Well, I mean, in fact, to quote Jesus, we will always have the poor. The real problem in this country and in Western Europe is the collapse of the middle class, of people who are actually pretty functional and trying really hard and following the rules that you wrote for them, and they're still failing. And kids who can't get married at 30 or afford a house because there are no jobs that will sustain a middle class family. That's the problem right there. And so I talk to rich people all the time, and they're like, well, we're sending a million jobs into Detroit, or we're pouring money into, you know, okay, that's great, and I'm totally for that. That's the easy way out, actually. The harder way is to figure out, why is it that a guy with 105 IQ who's making 65 grand and married to a woman who also works can't keep his marriage together because the financial pressures are too profound? Like, that's the real problem. Nobody cares
so
about that.
Let's talk about something that may fly in the face of sort of like the president's logic. So President Trump talks a lot about how the economy is doing. And there's a bunch of good economic indicators, you know. Lowest unemployment ever for all sorts of racial categories, that's great. The economy's churning forward, GDP growth is getting to the targets that his economists want, above 3%. They're constantly trotting out all these positive economic numbers.
Mm-hmm.
What's the rot underneath that isn't being?
I mean, there's so many layers of stupidity and all that it's hard even to wade through them. But I would say, for one, why are we breaking down economic numbers by race? I mean, there are all kinds of assumptions there that are silly. I mean, the truth is, if you disaggregate, if you look a little more deeply into those numbers, you know, they include recent immigrants from other countries. So when we think of, you know, America's racial problem, America's original sin, which was slavery, and it really was America's original sin,
and its consequences do reverberate through the centuries. I believe that, because it's true. We haven't actually solved for that at all. What you're doing is, okay, so those numbers are always a lot less meaningful or meaningful in ways that are different from the ways the politicians do.
So American Sin, that's in, if I'm getting you correctly, anybody who was affected by racism and their family line, that issue has been sort of papered over by immigration.
Of course. Of course. I mean, the average Nigerian immigrant makes more than the average native-born white American.
Yes.
So this is my other problem with racializing everything. It just, it's dumb, actually.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you the real story. It doesn't tell you what's really happening. It's not about race. And because the people in charge are dumb and lack any capacity for nuance or self-reflection, like, they're not even aware of this. You're like, oh, it's a racial problem. Really? It's so much more complicated than that. And so much harder to solve, but I don't know. Why do they pay you $10 million a year? To solve the problem. So why don't you get going? They have zero interest. But, no, I mean, look, the numbers that I would look at are the more elemental numbers. Why is the suicide rate rising? I know four people have killed themselves in the past year and a half. In January of 2018, I know four people, all middle-aged white men. I'm not saying that for racial reasons. I'm just saying that's the category that you would think would be the most insulated from all of America's problems. And these were not four people either. Four of them. Maybe that's unrelated. It's not unrelated. Look at the numbers. Something really bad is going on with our social fabric. And I'm not sure it can be fixed by hiking GDP. I mean, our GDP, if you thought that the health of the country was reflected purely in the GDP numbers, this should be the healthiest country ever. But it's not. So, again, those numbers, they don't mean anything. Unemployment numbers, I mean, yeah, they mean something. But if you have a huge pool, the largest pool since the Great Depression, of working-age men who are not working and who are not counted by those numbers, what the hell is going on? Each one of those unemployed men, many of them living on disability or some kind of other government subsidy, represents a family that's been decimated. How'd you feel if that was your dad? How'd you feel if that was your husband? You probably wouldn't be married. Yeah, anyway, these are like, so, yeah. And the other thing that I think but never say, because I don't want to be a strict gloom and doom, but like, a society based on, an economy based on finance is a precarious system, especially for a country this big. It works for the city of London because it's a city.
Yeah.
Does it work for a country of 340 million people? I don't think it does, actually. And it shows you how unwise, I mean, why would a society lionize and promote a class of people who lend money for a living over people who actually make things? So, like, why is it more impressive to be an investment banker than it is to be a finished carpenter, a cabinet maker? Much less impressive, in my opinion. Much less impressive. And yet, you would think from listening to the dumbos running things that, like, really the highest level of achievement is to work to some freaking bank. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And, like, work on deals. I mean, it's, like, disgusting. I personally think it's disgusting. Maybe it's not disgusting. I don't know. It's just my preference, I guess. It is a little strange, and I think it's awfully telling that that's like the goal, is to go to some totally mediocre Ivy League school, get some meaningless credential and some pointless field of study, and then go to McKinsey and then work at whatever, Goldman. Like, if one of my kids did that, I would feel like a profound, I don't care how rich they got, I'd feel like a loser and a failure and a bad father. That they bought into the pointlessness of this ridiculous system.
You've ensured this won't happen, right, with any of your children before you get this on paper?
No, I told them that 1,000 times. Whatever you do.
Just to make sure, because, you know, we are...
Whatever you do, don't do that. Don't do that. You know, go live in Vermont and make candles. And as long as they're great candles, I will respect you and love you and be proud of you.
Yeah.
But whatever you do, don't participate in that garbage. And again, there are lots of things that, you know, someone needs to clean the sewers, okay? So I get it. There are lots of unattractive jobs out there that we need. We need finance. I'm not, you know, but the idea that that's, like, held up as, like, the goal. How sick is your society?
Yeah.
Like, how can that continue? It can't.
I'm And that was Tucker Carlson. I got a great interview. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. And I'm going to be taking my musical break right now. Here's a great song by, a great duet, by George Strait and Alan Jackson. It's Murder Was Committed on Mutant Music Row. And it's a song I think first recorded by the late George Jones, the Possum, and Dierks Bentley.
Nobody saw him running from 16th Avenue. They never found a fingerprint or the weapon that was used. But some wonky country music cut out its heart and soul. They got away with murder in their own music room. The almighty dollar and lust the worldwide fame slowly killed tradition, and for that someone should hang. They all say not guilty, but the was committed down on Music Row. The steel guitars no longer cry, and fiddles barely play, but drums and rock and roll guitars are mixed up in your face. Chance on today's radio says they committed murder down on Music Row. They said no one would bother more drinking and cheating the song.
Oh, I still find him drinking song, Jordan. There ain't no justice in it. And the hard facts are cold. That murder was committed down on Music Row. He wouldn't have a chance on today's radio, since they committed murder down on Music Row. Why, they even tell the Possum to pack up and go back home. There's been murder down on Music Row.
George Jones, as always, Alan Strait and Alan Jackson, Murder on Music Row. Here's another great song by Texas girl, Amber Digby.
Jukebox is
Another great song, a great singer, Bill Anderson, Whispering Bill Anderson, a stalwart in country music. I wonder if God likes country music.
We talked a lot today about our friends at the Grand Ole Opry as we salute the Grand Ole Opry on country's family reunion. I don't think anybody has mentioned the name of Roy Acuff, but I want to do that because some of my greatest memories of being on the Opry were the nights that Mr. Roy would come out on the stage and allow me to share the spotlight with him and do this song right here. I got a lot of wonderful memories. If we have time, I'll share some of you, but first I'd like to do the song, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope maybe you remember. One night we were out on tour getting ready to do a show. And at the time it really wasn't anything all that special. It was what you might call just another one-night stand. When I looked over my guitar, and there stood an old man. His cowboy clothes were frayed and worn, and his roots were far from near. He said, "I'd like to sit in with your band." You see, I'm a country singer too. Yeah, well, we just all had a big laugh. When I looked back at the old man, there was a tear in his eye. So I told the band to coo, because I didn't want to see him cry. He reached down and he took my guitar, and with a determined look on his face. But then as he started to play and sing, A look of sadness took its place. He said, I've sang my songs from Maine to California. Sing the world through the window of a car. I never made a dime back when I made it, never saved a dime.
Song by Whispering Bill Anderson. This is Paul Frong. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. Show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore, from Britain shore, would the dauntless hero planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom homes and loved ones dear firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the Maple Leaf forever. The Maple Leaf, our emblem dear, the Maple Leaf forever. God save our queen. Oregon now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever.